I'm very happy now to welcome Kim Mueller. She is a chef. She is a member of the Chefs Collaborative and has a recipe in the Chefs Collaborative Cookbook, Local, Sustainable, Delicious Recipes from America's Great Chefs. And she will be speaking this Thursday at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So tell us about the Chefs Collaborative.
Well, the Chefs Collaborative is an organization that's headquartered in Boston. It is a nonprofit organization with about 12,000 members around the country. Mostly, I would imagine, if not all, chefs and involved in the food industry, producers as well, farmers, fishermen, anybody who's interested in promoting sustainability in the food supply. Basically, the collaborative grew out of a sort of a gathering of chefs in 1993 in Hawaii. There was probably about 20 of them. Some of them, many of them I know, two of them I have actually worked for. And it was basically a conversation to see how chefs could have an impact on some of the issues that were already starting to, you know, come up with regard to our food supply and sustainability. And out of that, you know, we went a continuing conversation, and in 2000 the collaborative was formally organized and continues to do a lot of really great work. They've and early on were doing some work with school lunch programs. They've been very involved in some of the helping to develop some of the standards with respect to sustainable seafood. They worked with the Monterey Bay Aquarium in establishing the guide from the aquarium, which is the Seafood Watch program that has regional guides about when to buy what and what not to buy and things like
that.
Yeah, that
it's become quite famous. It's a telephone app, and it's actually influenced my own, like when I buy fish, I'm so, okay, I'll buy tilapia,
right?
Because that's on the good list on the Monterey Aquarium.
So it's so those are a couple of the big things, and then ongoing are just, they do a lot of different events regionally and nationally. I think right now the big one is with respect to Bristol Bay salmon, which is something they do almost every year, where they get chefs to do dinners to highlight Bristol Bay. And that's an area that's one of the areas that's sort of endangered as far as salmon fishing and just the viability of wild salmon in general, which is kind of under attack everywhere.
Right, right.
Because of pollution. I think last month, every year during Earth, around April, they do Earth dinners, get restaurants to sign up to promote Earth Day and just all of those kinds of things. And then every year in the fall is a big sustainability conference. I attended, the first one I went to was in 2011 in New Orleans, which was a lot of fun. This year it's in Charleston, so I'm hoping I can sneak away because that's a place I've always wanted to go. So, and there's just lots of workshops and speakers and, you know, little brainstorming groups to talk about different issues. It's really great. They do a lot of great work.
So this started in 1993 when people got together in this meeting in Hawaii. 20 years ago, a lot has changed since then, both in the public consciousness and in the food industry consciousness.
Absolutely. I mean, I, you know, as I've been thinking about all the things, you know, that sort of got me to this point, you know, when I started cooking in the early 70s when I was a college student, but you know, just things that have changed along the way, but even since the early 90s, you know, the availability of more sustainable proteins, fish. I mean, at least in California, which is where I'm from and where I spent a big part of my life, you know, there's always been good access to fresh local produce. And so I think we see a lot more of that now, but and in the restaurant industry especially, it's definitely changed, and chefs are becoming more and more aware of how important it is to think about what they're buying. It's still a big issue in terms of affordability for restaurants, but you know, we have the opportunity as chefs and being more and more in the public eye, which was part of what they talked about in 93, was that all of these chefs that gathered in Hawaii were all pretty famous and are still, most of them all very well known and very influential. And so the thought was that we had the opportunity to really, you know, bring a lot of things to light that might otherwise not be thought about by the general public, you know, and that with our influence and sort of celebrity as chefs, we had a chance to sort of not necessarily influence, but really bring to light for the average consumer how important some of these issues are.
And it turns out to be, in fact, very influential.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
People's thinking, especially in places like Santa Fe, New Mexico, and a lot of cities with kind of green-oriented populations.
Yeah.
I mean, it's both what we buy, where we buy it, and what restaurants we choose to go to and what we demand from those restaurants has really shifted enormously.
Yeah, yeah, and everyone, you know, is in their own way, at least locally. I think everyone, for the most part, in the more, whatever you want to call them, sort of higher-end restaurants, and even not others. I mean, you know, a lot of the small local restaurants, like, you know, Atrisco, I mean, George does a fair amount of local stuff, obviously the chili, and he does some meat, and, you know, a lot of people are really trying. Obviously, he had the tie-in to the farmers market, having been involved for so long, and is still on the board, but, you know, a lot of little restaurants. There's Treehouse, there's Dr. Fieldgoods, Josh's new place, and he's trying to do some local things. And, you know, not everyone can do everything. It's very expensive. And so people try to do what they know they can afford to do as well and try to make a difference in some way.
This book, the Chef's Collaborative Cookbook, is not only a bunch of incredible recipes. I mean, there were a lot of recipes where I didn't even know the names of the foods in the title.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what are ramps?
Yeah, ramps are primarily found, I don't know that we find them around here. It's basically a wild onion or a wild leek. I've never actually cooked with them. But it's this time of year, it's sort of like asparagus and fiddleheads, and there's ramps, and it's a short season. And, you know, you basically just, I think, either throw them on a grill or cook them very simply, and they're, you know, you can turn them into lots of delicious things. And I, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's the beautiful thing about the book. I mean, there's a lot. You open to any random recipe, and there's a chance that there's something in it that you've never eaten and maybe never even seen if you're kind of the average non-chef out there. But the other thing that's nice about the book is that it has a lot of pages that are not recipes. And one of them, which I think is just really important to talk about, is, why is organic, sustainable food more expensive than, like, junky or less healthy mass-produced food?
I mean, I think, you know, in a nutshell, to you know, simplify it in the most easy way is that, you know, small farmers, ranchers, whatever, you know, don't get government subsidies. And, you know, more and more our food supply is you know, if you look, especially what's been going around the internet lately, is the whole list of the companies that own, you know, who own all the small organic companies who we all thought were so great are now, you know, ConAgra and Kraft and, you know, and those kind of companies, and the big, big producers get so much government money, you know, in agriculture subsidies. And that's a big part of it. And it, you know, it's more expensive to grow organically because you're not spraying the field full of pesticides to kill the weeds. You actually have to get people to go in and dig out the weeds by hand.
Right.
And that costs more money. So, you know, if you have 100 acres, you know, where you can fly over with an airplane and spray, now you might have to have 10 people, you know, pulling weeds every day.
Right.
And that's a very simple explanation. But
it's one of the many things, and organic food... if you want to have organic certification, it requires a ton of paperwork.
Exactly.
And if you want to spray pesticides, it doesn't. And why it isn't the opposite is still a mystery to me.
Well, it should be, because, you know, what we're doing to our water supply, and, you know, I mean, factory farming is so polluting in terms of animals, you know, hog farms, cattle. I mean, they produce an enormous amount of pollution in groundwater, and there's a book by Nicole Hahn, Nicolette Hahn. She's married to Bill Nyman, who's the founder of Nyman Ranch. And she's written a book on, it's called The Righteous Pork Chop. And she talks about flying over these big factory farms and seeing just, you know, the pools of waste and things that are just there. And it's, you know, it's easy to just get rid of things and not think about it, whereas organic farmers... They have to be very careful about what they do to maintain their certification and to just stay true to the principles. And it takes a lot more work.
We're talking to Chef Kim Mueller about the Chef's Collaborative Cookbook. In your experience, does organic and sustainably produced food also taste better?
I think it does. I mean, some people say it doesn't. But, you know, the other day, I mean, for example, we got some carrots the other day just at a regular store. And I was making macaroni salad to go with a hot dog last night for a little Memorial Day grill. And, and I ate this one of the carrots, and it was awful. It didn't taste like anything, you know. And an organic carrot that you get at the farmer's market or Whole Foods or wherever, it tastes like a carrot. It's sweet. It's juicy. It's delicious. You know, tomatoes. I mean, for example, and tomatoes are another one that's just a horrendous, you know, industry in the conventional tomato. You know, whereas the tomatoes we buy at the farmer's market, they're harvested ripe. Whereas tomatoes that come from, you know, they're grown in sand in Florida, are picked green, piled in a truck, and gassed. And, I mean, that they don't taste like tomatoes.
They don't taste very good. So they really don't.
So the things that are truly seasonal and clean, I think they taste so much better.
Now, do you cook seasonally? Do you cook according to what's in season?
Yeah, I try. I mean, you know, clearly in Santa Fe in New Mexico, it's a big challenge. I mean, what's in season here is pretty limited. So, you know, we're forced to buy from out of state. I have a great organic produce supplier in California that I work with. But I don't put tomatoes on the menu in the winter or, asparagus or... You know, because all of those things are coming from Mexico, Chile, who knows where. And, you know, the cost of transportation, that's not sustainable. So, I mean, that's, you know, sustainability isn't just about taking care of the land. It's about economic sustainability as well. And, you know, it doesn't make sense to fly fruit from New Zealand or Chile, or I guess they put it on a boat too. But either way, there's pollution, there's added cost, and so when and then it doesn't seem expensive in the grocery store, but so you buy it because it's cheap and it's what you want to eat, but it's really not the right choice.
Do you in the Chef's Collaborative work with, for example, economists and farmers and people who are envisioning a new food system?
I suspect that that's a big part of what goes on. I mean, I'm the board does a lot of different things, but I think, you know, as the collaborative continues to grow, I mean, and this book is a huge step in terms of reaching a broader community, and that's one of the reasons they chose to do this book. I think that's an important conversation that is happening in different parts, you know, of the country. And it is. I mean, there has to be a way to make sustainable food production more economically viable. There has to be a way. And if the government would funnel a little bit of the billions of dollars of subsidies they give to big agriculture to smaller farmers around the country, you know, we could make it work. I mean, you know, family farms are dying off at a really alarming rate.
And have been for 30
long
years.
Yeah. And now, at least, I think around the country now, the average age of the small farmer is in their late 50s. And what's happening is that, you know, the children of those farmers are not interested in carrying on the family farm.
But then there's all these, like, greenhorns movement of these young people coming
in. It's starting. Yeah. But we need, I forget what the number is, but, you know, we need tens of thousands of new farmers if we're going to change our food supply, you know, into more small, back to the way it used to be. You know, my great-great-grandfather was a farmer in West Virginia.
Is that
right?
Know,
he had 13 kids, you know, so he had plenty of help to work on the farm. But some of that family farmland is still around. I don't think it's being used. It's not working farmland anymore, but it's still in the family. And it's different. People don't have as many children anymore. It's a different way of life that we have now. I believe that it's possible to change, you know, change how we produce our food. It's just the government has to take some responsibility, and they're not. And, you know, here, you know, we thought our current president was going to do a lot of great things, and he has, but, you know, he is not standing up to Monsanto, you know. And that whole Supreme Court decision that just came down for this one poor farmer who Monsanto sued because they accused him of planting seeds without, you know, paying the patent fee or whatever. And, you know, and he's like a 70-some-year-old farmer, and he's taken on Monsanto, and he lost.
Yeah.
And now they want to collect $400,000 or something from him that he probably doesn't have.
Right.
And, you know, I don't understand how it's legal to patent something from nature. I just don't get that. It's not right.
I got an email from a very conservative friend the other day who said, even I hate Monsanto. They give capitalism a bad name.
Absolutely. I mean, they're, you know, they will sue people just because some of their pollen drifts into another person's non-Monsanto planted field and accuse them of patent infringement.
Right.
I mean, that there's something wrong with that. I just don't understand how that's even legal.
And the legal, the so-called justice system confirms that.
Yeah.
Now, very big problem, and as we've discussed in just about every context in the United States of America, money seems to be in charge, and nobody really knows how to get money out of the political system so that we can start making decisions based on what's right, not
Absolutely.
Just on the money thing. But that's if anybody knows the answer to that, please write to radiocafe@ksfr.org.
And really?
We will spread
it's the
word.
It's definitely my theory that, well, nothing will ever change until we take the money out of elections.
Yeah.
It's just never going to change.
Meanwhile, you became a chef. Well, how did what's your story? How did you become
a chef? It's nothing particularly interesting other than the fact that I grew up with parents, both of whom who liked to cook, were good cooks. My dad actually, you know, when he enlisted in the Army in 1953 or whatever it was, 52, and they're like, what do you want to do? You could do this, this, this. And, you know, one of them was being a cook. So he's like, yeah, I'll be a cook. So this was, you know, just around Korea, but he was stateside his whole duration in the service. But so he ended up becoming sergeant first class or whatever, and was, you know, head mess sergeant at the Presidio of Monterey, having been transferred there from the Fort Ord after he had an altercation with a captain. And his CO did him a favor and got him the heck out of Fort Ord. But my mother, who married my dad when she was quite young, did not know how to cook when they first got married. She was 16. And so clearly he was the cook for a while, and then gradually, you know, she taught herself to cook. And this was obviously, you know, little as she learned, it was Julia Child, and, you know, Cooking America was starting to change. And I was born in 1955, and so that was kind of that time. And she started cooking, and she's an amazing cook. And she's a vegan now at 75 and has been for quite a while. And actually at 62, she went off to Paris and went to Cordon Bleu for a while, and realized she knew most of everything that they taught her there. But so I grew up sort of around that, and, you know, obviously, I mean, in California at the time, you know, we didn't have a farmer's market in Santa Barbara, and now the Santa Barbara farmer's market's one of the best I've ever been to. It's just amazing all year round. And, but, you know, obviously we had great local fish. You know, there was a lot of great local food. You just didn't think about it back then. And so I probably started cooking a little, you know. I made myself eggs in the morning or whatever, and then when I went off to college, I cooked for myself. I never lived in the dorms. We didn't really have, there weren't dorms at San Jose State at that time, and so I lived on my own right away and cooked for myself. And at some point I got a job, I think my freshman year, in a place, and I was fired not too long after because I think the boss was not a very nice guy, and I probably said something and got fired.
You had an altercation with the captain?
Yeah, exactly. And so then I had a succession of jobs in college, and the only sort of chain place I worked in was Round Table Pizza, which at that time was a small Northern California company. And I actually find it, you know, looking back, it was a very valuable experience. And just kind of kept cooking. That was how I put myself, you know, through school, and just kept learning and learning. Worked in a couple nice restaurants in San Jose, and then I went off to graduate school and worked in a few places out there in Pennsylvania. And at a certain point, I was like, you know, I liked what I was studying in college, and my ambition was to be a college-level tennis coach because I'd played tennis since I was a kid. But I was like, no, you know, it's time to move on. I'm not going to go anywhere with this unless I get a PhD, and I was way done with school. So I went off to New Jersey and just started working in restaurants and kept working my way up. And that's kind of, you know, I got a job in New York in 1987 at a pretty big place in the seaport. And that was where I met Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger, who at that time owned the Border Grill restaurant in L.A. and City Restaurant. And they were the consultants for the menu on this restaurant that I went to work as a sous chef. And I was kind of wanting to go back to California, so they offered me a job a year later when the current chef was leaving. So I went back to L.A., and that was really, you know, that was kind of a seminal moment for me in my career, because it was a very high-profile restaurant, and still, you know, they still have three of them. And I learned a lot from them. You know, it was sort of my semi-paid culinary education.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
Education in culinary arts, I mean, when you are working in a restaurant, do people actively, the people you're learning from, do they actively teach you things? Now, here's how you cut that. Now, here's what you put together. You just watch?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little of everything. It really depends. You know, I had a chef, and it was really at that particular point I was thinking about going to culinary school, because I was working at a brand new hotel, a Hilton hotel in New Jersey. And I was probably one of the few out of a fairly large staff that was not a culinary graduate. There were guys there from Johnson & Wales. This is 1984. Johnson & Wales, Culinary Institute of America, and there was me. And, you know, in some ways, I look back on it, and even my chef, I think, agreed. I was really like the best cook in the place in terms of just knowing how to move around a kitchen, you know, and organize myself. And that's something that I think now they're doing a better job in culinary schools of more hands-on experience. But, you know, it's like any kind of education. It's really good, and it teaches you a lot, but until you get in and do whatever it is you're learning to do, you don't learn everything you need to learn from school.
Very interesting. So it's not just, I mean, it's not just about knowing your ingredients and chemistry and food science and all of that stuff, but when you say being organized and moving around a kitchen, there's a kind of like human bodies in space.
Very much. It is. And just, you know, the timing factor. I mean, home cooks can, you know, can definitely appreciate that. When it's Thanksgiving and you've got seven things that you're putting out, it's like, okay, are they all going to be done at the same time? And that takes a long time to learn. I mean, I remember when I did Christmas dinner for my mom, you know, I'd come home from back east and was doing this big elaborate dinner out of Gourmet magazine. It was like a Bavarian Christmas dinner with a goose and all this. And it was like the first time I ever had this big meal all come together at once. I was so proud of myself, but it's because it's a really hard thing to learn. And I think, you know, when I finally realized I knew how to do that, you know, that was when I, you know, figured I was on my way. But it you know, and there's just so much stress and just unknowns in a restaurant environment that you can't learn at school, you know.
Yeah, so. I mean, what are the stresses in a regular restaurant environment that...
Well, it's hot. There's a lot of noise. I mean, it's very noisy, you know. I mean, I've been in some kitchens. I ate at the French Laundry several years ago, and I remember getting... And it was lunch, so it was quiet, but I got to at least see the kitchen, and there was no speaking. You know, some kitchens can be very disciplined and quiet, and others are, you know, there's just clanking and noise and pans, and, you know, so you have to, sometimes you just have to get to a place where you don't even hear any of that, you know. And I've had times, I remember once in the compound, it was Easter Sunday, and we'd gotten just killed in the beginning with a number of people sitting down at once, and I was running the line. It's when I was the chef de cuisine there, and it's, I don't know what was going on. There was just all this talking and noise, and Mark Kiffin, the chef and owner, was there with his daughter for Easter, and he had kind of come in, you know, and he was behind me, and I didn't realize it at first, and there was just all this commotion, and finally I was just like, shut up, everyone. And I looked back, and he just like turned around and snuck away. But, you know, it gets crazy. It just can get really crazy sometimes, and especially in a bigger restaurant. But
and the chef really has to set the head of the kitchen, has to really set the tone of whether you're clanking around, whether you're talking, or whether it's a quiet, disciplined place.
Yeah. I mean, I like it to be quiet and calm, and, you know, it's just, it's easier for everyone that way. I mean, because, you know, the guys that are back there cooking, it's hot, they're stressed out. I mean, you know, there might be five people cooking for, you know, 150 people who've all sat down within the same hour and a half or something, and it's very, very different. It's a different way to make a living for sure. But, you know, there's nothing like a really, really busy night and then it's over and you realize that no plates came back, everyone was happy, and you feel really good about what you've done.
Now, so. Being a cook, what do you eat at home? Do you still have joy in cooking for yourself?
I do, but, you know, we eat pretty simply at home. I mean, I cook a lot of pasta, do a lot of stuff on the grill, and, you know, it's not anything fancy. I mean, I have my little junk food, you know, moments too, and we'll eat an occasional something I won't say, but... But I, you know,
I can only guess. Yeah. Doritos.
Once in a while, I'm not real big on snack food stuff. I, you know, I'll eat a Marie Callender's pot pie sometimes or something, as long as I don't look at the sodium content on the back. But definitely, my recent health journey has, you know, changed some of my eating habits a little, and I find I, for whatever reason, I do like to eat a little cleaner and a little lighter. I had a lot of dietary restrictions for the last year or so. You know, but really, it was hard for me, but because it was, you know, just things I really liked to eat that were good for me that
and
I had to
had,
be careful with.
You had a kidney disease, and the whole community really beautifully came
Absolutely,
together
yeah,
to support
I,
you.
You know, it's that was an extremely humbling experience. First of all, that a friend of mine was willing to put it together, and that people actually showed up.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. I showed up at the very end because I, you know, I didn't want to be there, but it was nice to see the... You know, the remnants of what went on that evening, for sure.
We're talking to Chef Kim Mueller, who has a recipe in the Chef's Collaborative Cookbook. Now, tell us about, it's a soup recipe.
It is. I think the official title is the Southwestern Heritage Bean Soup, and it just sort of came about by, you know, just happenstance. I had offered to host the board of the Chef's Collaborative for dinner at the supper club where I was working out at Real Food Nation at the time in 2011. They were having one of their quarterly board meetings in Santa Fe. I knew a few of the board members, so I kind of put it out there. And we ended up hosting, I think, about 20-something. It was whatever we could fit in the dining room, which is about 25. And so obviously I wanted to do a locally driven menu, and it was March, so we were kind of still in winter. And so this soup was... just one of those things that just sort of came together on the stove. I had tepary beans, which come from the Pima Indians in Arizona, which are just delicious little beans. And Chico's, which I had bought from a guy over in San Jose, I think, near Ribera, and who's still using the seed from his grandfather, I think. And, you know, it's a great little story. He was a really cool guy. And local pinto beans and green chili, and it just came together as this really delicious soup with a little pancetta for good measure because everything's better with a little bacon in it. And
that is so true.
And, yeah, it was just a really delicious soup. So when they sent around an email looking for recipes, I was like, well, I'll send this one in, and they ended up using it. So I was quite thrilled. It's the first time I've been published in a cookbook. So
awesome.
It's very exciting. And Deborah Madison also has a recipe in that book, and I think we're the only two local kind of this part of the world chefs in the book. But
well, it's an awesome and beautiful and inspiring cookbook, and you, Kim Mueller, will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday night at 6 o'clock here in Santa Fe talking about the Chef's Collaborative Cookbook, Local, Sustainable, Delicious Recipes from America's Greatest Chefs. And the photography in it is fabulous.
It's
too.
Really, it's just a, I mean, I, when I got my copy in the mail, I, you know, I emailed back to Melissa Kogut, who's the executive director, and I was like, you know, it's just gorgeous. It's a really a beautiful book, and I was actually in Santa Barbara in early March and went with some friends. I was staying with actually the two ladies who own Edible Communities, the parent organization of all the edible magazines like Edible Santa Fe, and we went to one of the local bookstores called Chaucer's in Santa Barbara, and I'm looking through the cookbook section, and there it was, and I hadn't seen it yet. So, and then I got my copy about a week or so later, but it's just really a wonderful book and full of amazing information, and I'm excited about it, and I'm really glad that Dorothy offered me a slot, and I'm going to be talking with Rob DeWalt. I was trying to decide. I didn't want to talk by myself, and and she's, you know, I was racking my brain, and then I was chatting with Rob on Facebook, and it came to me, and I asked him, and he said yes. So it should be fun. He's a fun guy to talk with.
He's great, and he's a real food guy.
Yeah, he is, and I've known him since he was working the restaurant that went in to where Cafe Escalera was, that was short-lived, and I had my little cheese business then, and I took cheese to them one time, and he was behind the line cooking, I remember. So,
well, Kim Mueller, we want to thank you very much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe, and we'll see you on Thursday.
Thank you so much.
I'd like now to welcome back to the program Thomas Larson. He's author of the book The Memoir and the Memoirist, and on June 10th, he is starting a week-long workshop at the Presbyterian Church here in Santa Fe on memoir writing. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having me.
So you have been interested in memoir for a long time, and memoirs have become very popular over the last, 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. What do you think that's all about?
Well, there's a number of reasons for its explosive growth, as you say, in the last 20 years. 20, 30 years ago, we really didn't have the memoir form. It just sort of came out of autobiography and the personal essay. Writers and everyday people have been responsible for its popularity. I think a number of factors are at work. One is that there's an aging population. There's lots of people, shall we say, over 50 post-career who have free time and they want to write. They want to do something artistic. Memoir has been very successful in the publishing world. Something like 6 or 7 of the top 10 bestsellers have been memoir or biography consistently for the last 15 or 20 years. And these books have been written by famous people, but also by unknowns. Sometimes we call it the nobody memoir, the memoir by someone who just has an incredible story to tell and writes very well. Both are possible in the memoir world. You can write from fame, from television, from the fact that you have national exposure. And you can also write from this knowing place of individuality that your life has been interesting enough to explore with a memoir. Another really interesting thing, I think, of late is this idea of the blog to the book, which has just come about in the last 10 years or so, that people who have blogs, which is in essence an online diary, and they have converted those pieces because they have large audiences and mass followers into books. So this is probably the newest phenomenon is the blog to book. I think of a book like Julia and Julia, the memoir got made into a movie as well, but the idea that she did a cooking blog that was followed by a lot of people over a couple of years and then made a book out of it. It's really part of the explosive growth.
Now, one of the things that is a question that I think a lot of readers have is, I mean, if you're thinking about writing a memoir, maybe it's interesting enough to be published, but there's a good chance that it isn't, although mm-hmm. your friends and family might be very happy that you did write it. But there's a lot of people writing who maybe their lives just aren't really worthy of being, not that there's anything wrong with their lives, but their story is not a story that should be out there because it doesn't have universal appeal, or they're not a good enough writer.
Yes, that's true. However, memoir by its nature is specialized. It emphasizes a particular relationship. It emphasizes things like place, childhood, adolescence, career, job, travel. Memoirs can be very specific. The whole idea about audience is there isn't such a thing, I think, as a universal audience unless you're on unless you come through one of the talk shows and your story is popularized via popular media. But the great growth of memoir has been in all these niches.
Like my parents were evil, abusive drug
absolutely.
Addicts kind of niche.
Absolutely. And we have, what I keep track of is sort of this, these vast categories of the different types of memoir. We have a huge number of illness memoirs, which then subdivide into things like heart disease or cancer or the grief memoir, the memoir about death and dying, the Alzheimer's memoir. Some of these books are closer to the how-to realm because they involve medical knowledge, perhaps, that
right.
readers may want.
So it's about helping other people who are going through the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. And again, as you say, these can be well-written or poorly written. It really depends. Memoir has this phenomenal usefulness about it that is very attractive to people, that often when people get into bad situations, like a divorce, they go to the bookstore or they go online and they look for memoirs of divorce. How did other people handle what I'm going through? I'm 30, about to split up. I have two children. You know, we 20 years ago, we didn't have these books. Now we have literally thousands
gajillions of them.
Gajillions.
Yeah. I wondered at a certain point why somebody hadn't written a book. You know how there's all those stages of death and dying?
Mm-hmm.
Analogous stages of post-divorce really
yes.
could be written.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I may think of one that sort of does it. Well, the classic is Eat, Pray, Love, where
right.
she leaves after a bad marriage, bitter divorce, and she goes off and finds herself in a way that's very appealing. I wish I had gone off for a year like that after my divorce. I think I wallowed in my grief too long, and she seemed to have made an adventure of it.
And that's a good example of, I mean, there was an article about how if you write a memoir, especially if you're female, be prepared to be hated and attacked.
Yeah.
And she was somebody who really was simultaneously loved by many and hated and attacked by many others. What's going on? And why women in particular?
That's a good question. You may need a woman to answer that. I think that women... Well, let me say this. My workshops are often 80% women. I wish there were more men, but men culturally are not as engaged in the process of personal growth, etc. Women are, and they risk much more than men ever do, spilling secrets, telling truths, embarrassing people, themselves as well as their families, and so on. They're much more interested in exploring the significance of their emotions and their intimacies. And as a writer and a teacher, that's really fun for me to work with. Something I do in my own writing. So women basically, by virtue of their own vulnerability, are drawn to this form and sort of put themselves out there. I don't know why the culture attacks them. You know, the whole case currently of Amanda Knox is kind of interesting, in which you have sort of sexually liberated or a libertine young woman, and you also have a murder story, and a lot of
right.
people feel she's guilty.
Which she clearly didn't commit, if you actually look at it closely.
Right,
but.
Right. But this notion that stories like that with young women, especially if they involve murder, sex, and personal choice, seem to get covered by the media far more than the other kinds of books. And so it brings out that kind of backlash of the popular audiences always carry.
We're talking to Thomas Larson about memoir writing. Now, you talk about in your workshops the difference between good and bad therapeutic writing. What do you mean?
Well, therapeutic writing is always going to be involved with memoir, because after all, this is supposed to be the truth. It's supposed to be personal. You're the subject of it. The I is the author, the character, and the narrator. It's a very heavy burden to deal with.
Although I think it's probably very therapeutic for some fiction writers to write fiction.
Sure.
Even when they're not... Sure. Visibly recognizable.
Sure. And often I will suggest to people, because of the nature of the subject, it's that it's too close to them, that it's that it involves, as I said earlier, the embarrassment or the outing of family members and so on, to turn the book into fiction. The only problem then is if you do in fact take your story and fictionalize it, anyone who knows you will read it as if it's fictionalized autobiography.
Right.
So that seems to happen. But good and bad therapeutic writing has to do with, a lot of us keep journals in which we process emotion. Our anger is more raw. It's more inner directed rather than outer directed. And good therapeutic writing, I think, starts to say, well, who is my audience that I want to read this? How do I reach out to them with my inner angst, my repressed memories, etc.? How do I make a bridge between my journal writing and perhaps something that could be read by a wider audience? So this idea that therapeutic writing can move from one form to another is something I explore a lot in my work.
Have you found, I mean, there's a lot of memoirs out there, and some people have written two or more memoirs.
Oh, yeah.
Are the second and third ones as strong? I mean, do people have multiple memoirs in them?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There is such a thing as a serial memoirist. The woman who comes to mind is Maya Angelou, who basically has written a multi-volume autobiography of her life. But what she does beautifully is she encapsulates each particular portion and really emphasizes the emotional horror of it, or the emotional growth, whatever it is. She had some really rough experiences as a child. And so she'll concentrate on a few years to exemplify childhood or adolescence or college or career or poetry or whatever. So yeah, a lot of memoirists are realizing that we can write about many different aspects as long as we do not just fly the plane over, but land and, you know, get out of the cockpit and go into the jungle and find what's there to expand. The other thing I love about memoir is it doesn't have to be long. Good memoirs are short. They're intense. They're complicated. One of my favorite books is called Half a Life by Darren Strauss. And when he was 18, driving his car, he accidentally hit a classmate who was riding her bicycle, who may have swerved in front of her, and she was killed. That incident, which he describes in three pages at the beginning of the book, is like the point of a spiral. And from it, the entire book sort of aches its way out from that core. And everything in the book is related back to that. He doesn't talk about, you know, his college career or his writing career or his sister and brother or his parents very much. He spins it from this very hot moment. And he writes about a 30,000-40,000 word memoir. And it's so gripping because he has to resolve this, something he lives with and he's haunted by, but the form just has this way of sort of filling you the more specific and the more emphatic it is when it stays on its emotional core.
I would think that part of what students have to really learn and struggle with when they're in a memoir writing workshop or when they're writing their memoirs is not only telling the factual truth, but as you say, telling the emotional truth, which may be painful either to themselves or others.
Yeah, that's a good distinction, the factual truth and the emotional truth. And the emotional truth is really the opposite, because it should be filled with doubt and anxiety and supposition. First of all, how do we know how we felt when we were remembering back 40 years ago when we were 23 or 17? How do you know what you felt? I don't think you do. I think what happens is your emotional memory recycles itself over and over and over, and you create your own fantasies. Sometimes they become untrue or lies, or they become so exaggerated others can call you on it because they may have remembered things differently or even more accurately than you. So that's something all of us, in a sense, that's what's different about memoir from fiction, is that with memoir we get to struggle with this conflict between factual and emotional truth. And that's not true of fiction. You can always change things to fit a character or a time or a place. The character can have a different life than you had.
We're talking to Thomas Larson. Now, I remember years ago I read that book, Angela's Ashes,
yes,
by Frank McCourt, and I was struck by how good-natured and sweet and full of humor he was writing about such a pretty awful childhood that he had. I don't remember the details anymore. And it seemed such a contrast to the sort of poor me, I suffered, and I'm blaming others kind of memoir that other people write.
Yeah, yeah. In a sense, he wrote that book when he was 63, and he recalls his childhood in Ireland. You know, it's the great misery memoir. I think the fact that 50 years had passed had allowed him to embrace a wider palette, a bigger stage, a grander sense of the mythic life, that he was able to look back at it. And this is what happens with people, is that we, if the story is old enough and moldy enough, it will turn into myth. Another thing that you should be aware of, that you're part of the mythologizing of your own story. And even though McCourt's book is a pure narrative, he never enters in and talks about it from his perspective as an old man. You can feel this quality of this, as you say, this universality of what did he say? The Irish, the greatest story of all is the miserable Irish childhood. there's none better.
Very interesting. Thomas Larson is author of the book The Memoir and the Memoirist, and so you're going to be teaching a week-long memoir writing workshop at the Presbyterian Church here in Santa Fe from June 10th to 14th, and basically beginners or advanced writers or anybody can sign up for it.
Yes, all levels are welcome. I like to have a mix, and so do the writers themselves, and yeah, we're going to concentrate on four different things quickly. I'm going to learn where each student is, how I can help them with their individual writing. I'm going to activate it with a lot of different prompts that I use. Largely what we do is do a lot of in-class writing in the morning. In the afternoons, we'll do read and critique, where people will bring in their work. And we're also going to discuss a full-length memoir, Mary Gordon's Circling My Mother, which is one of the best titles, I think, for a daughter-mother relationship memoir I've ever heard, because it's very tough to write about mom when mom is dying. She's 94, she has Alzheimer's, and you're trying to finish your lifelong relationship with her. That's what Gordon sets out to do in the book, and it's so really brilliant.
And that's the reading for this
class. That's the book we're going to read, yeah.
Very interesting. Well, Thomas Larson can be found at thomaslarson.com. And for registration and information about the workshop, you can also call the following phone number, and it's area code 858-717-1293. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're welcome.